Good morning and welcome to the June 1st, 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for both calling in and Skyping in this morning. In the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted virtually. Members of the public that might be on the phone are encouraged to make comments and to ask questions. If you do wish to speak, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will open up phone lines for such comments later in the session this morning. This morning's meeting is a study session. The business session will start at 1 o'clock today. Today we have all five commissioners on the phone, as well as General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, are in the boardroom. If you would please take a second and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States Republic, for which it stands, nation under God, thank you, everyone. Let's just right into the agenda. Any item on the consent agenda shall be subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Are there any such requests?
Commissioner Arsenault.
Yes, Commissioner Smith.
Yes. Per the recommendation that came to us from management, I would like to suggest that agenda items 10, 11, 12, and 13 be moved to the consent agenda.
Do we hear a second?
Mr. Chairman, I second that motion.
Thank you, Commissioner Boltz. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. It sounds like unanimous. The ayes have it. Steve, can we move on to the regular agenda items?
We are ready to do that. So I want to start with the Public Power Benefit Program. Felicity Saberhagen is actually in the room today and will be presenting for us.
Good morning, Felicity Saberhagen, Business Manager. Here to talk about public power benefits. Now, this is the first of two updates each year. The purpose of this meeting is threefold. First is to consider allocating the remaining funds that we have for 2020. We also give an update on the achievements of the program and start planting seeds for 2021.
Commissioners, can you hear Felicity okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good.
I can too.
For 2020, we do have two employment supported employment positions that are funded. The Rocky Reach Discovery Center has begun and is under construction. Day use park passes. We've issued 1,300 this year before Memorial Day. And our fiber program continues with expansion and infill. And as of March 31st, they were actually on track.
Felicity?
Yes.
How does the issuance of day use passes compare with the past couple of years?
So normally we have issued most of them by about this point in time. And I think last year we were about at 1,700 this year. So we are a bit less, although I think that's to be expected. And I think 1,300 under the conditions is pretty dang good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. If we look at the since launch, we have now covered 76% of the county with fiber, which includes an additional 3,400 premises that have been passed through this program. 9,000 day use park passes have been issued, and our Hydro Research Institute now has 8 plants that have been uploaded and are targeting 17 by the end of the second quarter. The Discovery Center closed last fall, and we are anticipating a grand reopening in spring of 2021. The supported employment program through the Jobs and Work Readiness Project has been extended through 2020 and has funding to be able to continue those positions through 2021. Normally,
Felicity,
oh, yes.
Commissioner Bowles.
Yes.
On the reopening of the Museum and Discovery Center, I know there's been some construction delays. So does the planned reopening in the spring of 2021, is that still holding?
That is still holding at this point in time.
Okay.
You will also be getting a project update in August on the overall program on that. So if you have additional questions regarding how that fits in terms of timing, that would be a great time to ask those questions.
Perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Normally, I would be here also this time of year to ask to set the financial funding. On March 30th, the board reviewed and reviewed the an opportunity to go ahead and fund the program from through the strategic planning cycle and opted to fund it with $6 million per year. This is great news because this now gives us an additional $3.5 million to consider allocating for 2020. There are four projects that are in the works right now that are potentials for funding through this program. First being the wastewater Dryden treatment plant. This is a project that was discussed during the strategic planning cycle and estimated at about $1.5 million at that time. Fiber acceleration is also part of the strategic planning process. And at this point in time, we don't have additional funding, but are expecting to have better numbers by mid-July. And likely at the July 20th presentation, you would be hearing about additional fiber acceleration opportunities. The Rocky Reach Discovery Center, as I mentioned, is under construction. At this point in time, we are not anticipating needing any additional funding, but the final construction packet is to be bid at the beginning of July. So if there is additional funding, we would be coming back to you in August with in that update asking for additional funding. Yes.
This is Ann. On the funding for the Discovery Center, I think I remember maybe 6 months ago or maybe not that long ago, we heard that they had to scale back, cut back somewhat to meet budget. So is that the case? Did they do that? And what's the status of that? And at to what degree?
So at the time, they weren't sure what those exhibits were going to look like. When the final choices came around, we were able to do all of the exhibits we wanted to do with the existing funding. And remember, too, we also added $125,000 from last year's cycle. So right now, we're funded at $1.125 million. So with that, we were able to look at that and make the decisions within that and not have to make big compromises regarding the exhibits.
So that was the original budget, so they didn't have to scale back anything, cut anything out.
Correct. The whole program is funded a couple of different ways. Just the new story and the viewing corridor and the replacement of the windows for the fish viewing are funded through public power benefits. The remainder of the program is funded through O&M and capital operations.
Capital, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Coronavirus support. So as this unfolds, we may know a little bit more about ways that we might be able to contribute within the community. At this point in time, we don't have anything to bring forward, but as we know more, we will be bringing things forward as within our statute of limitations. For 2021, again, we have these same four projects that are under consideration. We don't know what all of those amounts look like yet, so we're not requesting to allocate anything at this point in time out of 2021, but we will be back to, as we know more, to fully fund those this project here. So next steps, if the board desires to go ahead and...
Felicity?
Yes.
This is Randy. Back on that last one, maybe I just lost a conversation that's occurred. The access to the river, is that down at the Verant Grand property?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Then I'm clear on what it is. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Felicity, just remind the board that I believe there is some funding already allocated under PPP for that?
Correct. Thank you. There is $1.2 million has been allocated to help cover that. If you are interested in the current projects that are ongoing within the Public Power Benefit Program, there is an appendix to this presentation that lists all of the projects and what has been spent and what is remaining. So with that, we do have an opportunity to go ahead and fund the Dryden Treatment Plant right now with $1.5 million. We recognize that this is an estimate. We're still in conceptual design, so that funding amount may need to change. But at this point in time, we would request that we fund that for future planning purposes to allow the systems to utilize that in their financial planning. And that can be done today with a motion from the board. Second, we have the online public power benefit submission request that will be available in September. We're working on the design, so we have an opportunity to solicit things from the community, especially during this time frame where we're not as much face-to-face, but it would allow us to have a good online opportunity to pull in requests for our program. With that, too, we'll be returning in summer and possibly fall, as long as there are decision points still to be made with the 2020 remaining funds, as well as the 2021 funds.
Let me check one thing with our general counsel. Felicity used the term motion from the board. My understanding was that this would just be what we would traditionally call a head nod. That'll be a little difficult in this situation. So I think we would suggest that we do it by, if there is no objection to allocating $1.5 million for the Dryden project. So I'll call that question now. Is there any objection to that?
Thank you.
Commissioners?
No objection.
Yeah, Steve, the only question I have is the, it's an estimated $1.5 million. You know, with final funding to be determined. How close are we to final funding with the $1.5 million?
Not as
I know I said, Ned, but.
Yeah, not as close as we would like to be honest. So we've tried a couple of things out there, and neither of them have worked. And so we don't have a clear plan at the moment for how we would solve this problem. Some of the options that we're aware of seem very expensive for the number of houses served. So we are still in the process of working with Ecology to try to define what the program would be that would address the phosphorus levels.
Okay. So the issue is it just doesn't percolate appropriately as we've discovered.
Yeah, the soils are not what we were hoping they would be in the two sites that we've looked at.
Okay. My head is nodding, yeah.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. My head's nodding.
I think that's three nods. You got a fourth nod here.
We'll count that as no objection and continue to move forward with this program.
Great, thank you. Are there any other questions that I can answer for anyone today?
Great.
I don't think so. Hearing none. Thanks, Felicity.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is agenda item 4. Andrew Grissel will be presenting on electric vehicle strategy.
Morning. This is Andrew Grissel, manager of our implementation team. And I believe Jim White is also on the phone. And questions get to be technical. He's always there, a great resource, so he'll be there too. So I'm going to provide an update on our transportation electrification roadmap. We go to slide 2. The objectives, well, towards the end of 2019, 2020, district staff worked with EMI Consulting to develop a transportation electrification team. Engaged internal stakeholders from customer utilities, finance, and legal. We also engaged with external stakeholders, such as Inc. and Plug in North Central Washington. The objectives today are to review how transportation report in our county and to present the findings from the strategic growth development project. No decision is needed today. However, board feedback would be greatly appreciated as we start taking steps. We go to slide 3. A key to developing a roadmap is to understand the current EV landscape and what that looks like in Chelan County. EVs made up approximately 4% of new vehicle registrations in the county in 2019. This was double the rate in 2017. 1 in 3 EVs in Chelan County is a Tesla, followed closely by Nissan and then Chevrolet. Those three account for almost 167 EVs. The graph on the lower right shows the year-over-year growth of EVs. The graph on the left shows the new registrations by. As you can see, EV purchases are increasing, but they are still just a fraction of the of our light-duty vehicles. You can see that EVs make up just 0.5% of the total passenger vehicles in Chelan County today. So growing, not a large number yet. Slide 4. This slide highlights where and how EVs are expected to charge in the county. On the left is just a quick little showing of where EV charging stations are located in the county. There is, of course, we were missing the one up at left from the map, but there's the Tesla charging station up there as well. At-home charging is expected to be where most of the charging will occur, with relatively small amounts and even small at public fast charging locations. We don't expect to see a large impact from charging and even from workplace charging. However,
Andrew?
Yeah.
This is Randy. I'm looking at that map, and I don't see it on the scale. You've got two different colors of charging stations.
Great question. So the green, orange colored ones are fast charging stations, so a little bit higher speed. Green ones are typical level 2 fast charging stations.
Thank you.
Like we've got one down. One of those dots is going to be the one that's down behind the hotel, Coast Hotel, and the performing, for example. Let's see. For a DC fast charging station, those, of course, are left. We don't expect a lot of usage from. They are county residents. Those would be more as people are coming in, as tourists, want to stop, get the good start quickly, and then either go to their destination or stay here as the destination. So if we go to slide 5, want to do a current state. So this slide summarizes the current state of our transportation electrification. We have external factors that include state and federal policies. We know that there are more vehicles are being added to the EV menu all the time. Battery performance and price drop continue to head in the right direction, making EVs more applicable to a wider range of customers. As range anxiety goes down, as leads to a drop in price in cars, it's going to open it up to more customers. And customers in the Pacific Northwest see benefits from low fuel prices based due to our low electric rates and from those fuel resources being carbon free in large part with the large amount of hydro that we have in the Pacific Northwest. EV growth within Chelan County does have a negative impact on district finances as the new load takes away from market sales. This impact is approximately $1,100 per vehicle over the 10-year life of the vehicle. Now, there is a benefit to that. We had a study which provided us with this number, and there's also a side to that there's a benefit to the region of about $2,000 a vehicle, which accounts for not spending money on fuel, that money staying within the region. And so what we are always looking to try to do is to narrow that gap between that impact to us and that benefit to the region and to the customer participate. That can be done from a number of ways. One is, can we increase the revenue from EVs? So we'll talk a little bit more about this, but making sure we have the right rate and how do we develop big one. Another way is, well, there's impacts from potential impacts on infrastructure. Are there ways to reduce that through looking at time of use or looking at load shifting, offering customers something to not charge at certain times, manage charging. So there's different ways about which, we can try to come up with a solution to bringing those two numbers together. Also, our conservation programs have clear benefits to the utility and customers, and those also can help us absorb some of this new load from EVs. And then our resource planning and forecasting is taking into account EV growth. At this time, impacts on residential charging on our infrastructure is expected to be minimal. But we're always keeping an eye on that. As we developed our roadmap, we had guiding principles. Obviously, number one is do the best for the most for the longest for all of our customers. We also wanted the roadmap to provide the foundation to stay ahead of customer needs. We want to ensure proper cost recovery to avoid subsidies for transportation electrification. As we move forward, this will likely necessitate the need to develop the right rate, especially for the large fast charging facilities. And then several local groups have shown an interest in expanding public charging stations, including the county and port. So it's going to be important to stay engaged with them to understand what their desires are and to be able to offer input on infrastructure requirements, on the science of it, on just all the things that go into it. So that, if that's somewhere where they want to go, we make sure that we put them what's best for the whole community, the whole county. Slide 7. So there were a range of actions that we looked at. There's a range of strategies that go from reacting, which is just addressing things as they come, all the way to trying to accelerate the market. The results of our current state assessment, as well as staff interviews, indicate Schlamm's PUD, our preferred approach is to avoid the extreme ends and potential, the extreme ends of the potential strategic options and approach. And so we want to utility impact, but we also want to support our EV adopters. And so there are a number of things that we can do within there. We want to help provide low-cost charging to our customers, but we also want to make sure that we minimize rate impacts through cost of service rates for EVs or through for some of the large charging stations, maybe that market rate. We want to, plan our capacity investments to make sure that we're including that EV growth is included within that, however big that is. And we want to, we want on the supporting EV adopters, we want to proactively engage with those EV owners, let them know what's the best time to charge a vehicle to limit impacts to the rest of the system. And then just working with, looking with a private investment. If there's developed charging where private investment is unlikely. So someone's not going to come in. Maybe there's some grant funds or something like that that can help drive the cost of the infrastructure down. Because especially on the large charging stations, that's a big part of it. So we go to the slide 8. The resulting strategies and actions can help us smartly plan for transportation electrification work. Number one, gathering and analyzing data is the foundation for the other strategies. It's needed to come up with solutions to mitigate utility costs, set the right rate, have the information needed to have strong and informative dialogue with customers and with our stakeholders. And so we want to focus on these five areas. Gathering data, as I just said, is important. We want to look at ways to help mitigate any utility costs from EV load growth. We want to align our costs and revenues, so we want to make sure we're charging the right rate. We want to engage in dialogue both locally and with internal and external stakeholders. Charging stations, EV programs can span and impact many areas across the country. We have a good team developed for that. We want to understand external stakeholders, what their wants and desires are, and try to understand where we can help or on the other side, maybe steer people away if it's going to be extremely costly in some areas. Now we just want to continue to work with our customers and engage them with them on whatever the strategies that are the outcomes of the actions that are the outcomes of these strategies are, so that they understand both the benefits and the impacts, and then they can make good informed decisions. So if we go to slide nine is our proposed next steps. And so based on all the brainstorming and feedback from staff, external stakeholders, and our consulting team that we had, we proposed to formalize a cross-functional team to help navigate the roadmap. As I mentioned earlier, these programs can have impacts across the district, and we want to make sure that everything is thought through. Data is important, so we want to develop a data acquisition plan and schedule. What kind of data do we need? How do we get it? How will we use it to make decisions? So not just going and gathering data for data's sake. These actions will help us support rate development, will help us define cost recovery strategies. And finally, a priority strategy is how we support Link's transition to fleet electrification. Currently, we've been doing that with Jim's technical knowledge, and we're also assessing the benefits to Chelan PUD from their proposed combined charging and battery system, the public power benefit opportunity there. So they've gone out, they've gotten a grant. They're putting in a system that will both be large fast charging as well as a battery system involved. That battery system can have benefits to our system by decreasing the peak of when those buses come on to charge. They can pull energy off the battery rather than pulling it off our system. We're doing some analysis and work right now to see what that mean to us, and you know, is there a way that we could help support through public power benefits? And so that analysis is ongoing, and we hope to have something there, shortly, as far as bringing something forward. So if we go to slide eight, it's our discussion slide. One, request input from the board. Our next steps, we'll take that input as well as our work to date to develop a charter for the team and for the program, and then we'll develop our tactical plans and insert those into the district business planning process so we can get that in and make sure it's all planned out and thought through. And so I will
question.
Open questions. Yes.
Yeah, Andrew, this is Randy. And one question has been stuck in my head throughout this presentation. Good presentation, by the way. Thought-provoking presentation. But to provide context, and I don't know if you or Jim, either one, have it right now, but what is the cost per mile for the fuel on an electric car versus the cost per mile on an average gasoline car?
Oh, I'm sure Jim has that. Jim, are you on mute? Well, I can find that out for you. I know it's significantly less.
That'd be great.
I will make sure I get that. You might not have been able to get on or trouble. So.
Yeah, if he's like me, my computer just timed out, so he may have got timed out.
This is Dennis. I'm back on.
Welcome back.
So Randy, your question. Oh, I was just going to make sure I have the question. Cost per mile for gas and cost per mile for electric vehicle. Is that correct, Randy?
Yeah, that gives the average layperson an understanding of what type of, one component, the big component of cost differential between our current electric price on here in Chelan County versus if we had rapid charging stations and I don't know how this would work, what it would look like. I don't think we want to own and operate charging stations, but if there's companies that go in, we might have to establish a rate structure for rapid charging. What would that look like?
That's correct, yes. And that's one of the things that we propose as a strategy to look at this is, and I've breezed over maybe a little too quickly, slide nine, that public charging rate, potentially basing it off market pricing, understanding what that cost is on those, because they are so much more, they use so much more infrastructure and electricity. That's really important that we understand what those costs are and how we can go about recovering those costs. But yes, I will look at I will get that those numbers back to you on the cost operation cost per mile for both of the technologies.
Thank you.
Andrew, this is Gary. I have a question regarding Tesla's involvement. There was a time when Tesla would install rapid charge stations. Are they still doing that? And if so, is that an option for our community?
They are still doing that, and we just we have the Tesla station that is installed up in Leavenworth. So there's a large system up there installed. I know that they're also looking at there has been talk up in the Chelan area, but I don't know how far that's gotten. But those are really large. They require, I mean, I think there's a 1.5 megawatt transformer for the like that. So they require large infrastructure, and ensuring we get the right rate and the right cost is really important. And so we actually have some data loggers up on the Tesla station, and we're making sure that we get load profile data on those so that we can have a better understanding of what that looks like.
Thank you.
Andrew, this is Dennis. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I understand on the Tesla charging station, so only Tesla vehicles have the matching connection, and other manufactured vehicles don't have the ability to charge them.
You are correct, yes. So that is one of the, if we're looking at things for the longest, that's something that needs to be considered is right now, and if we go back to slide 4, at the very top, public DC DC is the fast charger. When we look at challenges, we have different plugs set.
Yeah.
And have separate networks. And so, green lot, or it, I can't think of the other one, right? There's another one. Now that they don't always communicate well together. And then there's Tesla, which is right. Tesla, only a Tesla can charge at a Tesla charging station.
Yeah.
And so there are those things to be considered, which again is back to making sure we good costs and good rates on those so that everything's fair.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
So, Andrew, I have one question based on Commissioner Bolt's question, and that is, are there adapters that can adapt the different plugs? The reason I'm going here is obviously, what technology do we adopt? It's sort of like Betamax and the VCR back in the day. If we're going to be spending money on charging stations, isn't that a risk if it's just isolated to a certain vehicle manufacturer?
There are, and so I think part of this is that I'm not sure we're necessarily want to get into that the charging station game as much as making sure that maybe we have infrastructure there, or we have the cost right for the infrastructure for someone else. We haven't gotten that far into it, so there's still a whole bunch of options, but devices that you can put at 41, but I don't think like from a Tesla to another. I know that like Tesla, they can think. Jim said he was having trouble unmuting, and so he texted me a couple times. He was having unmuting on the Skype, but he was so there are some of them that you can have different devices on the charge on the end of your charging so that you can charge at different ones, kind of like where you have I would say for like a cell phone, you can have the different you can plug yours into and maybe have different connections on the other end of it. So there is that, but that is a risk because there's not a standard plug inlet or outlet, and that's why I would from our standpoint, I think, we don't want to make bets on that. We should let the market determine what that's going to be. And I would, you know, something I would look at through these strategies and how we support this is, you know, again, I'm sure we price up structure is right. And we, you know, we don't, you know, maybe potentially we don't deal with the other end. So, but it's definitely something to consider. Does that answer your question?
It does, but it kind of raised another one, and that is, do we risk abandon infrastructure? I mean, is that, see where I'm going with that? It's if we build the infrastructure, and that whoever builds the charging station then turns out to be the loser, becomes the Betamax, you know, do we have a problem with that?
Well, I get, yeah, and I think, again, that comes back to what do we charge up front for that cost recovery mechanism to make sure that our customers are made whole on that. So I think they're great questions that have to be considered as this is moving forward. And that is, you know, information I can take back and put in, you know, to, okay, you know, one of the things we want to make sure we're really being cognizant about is really, you know, we want to minimize or get rid of potential for any kind of stranding of assets.
Thanks, Andrew.
And Jim did text me, Commissioner Smith. Let's see, Jim did text me a cost, electricity cost 27 cents per gallon. So from a gallon perspective, you can look at that compared to a gasoline, which I know it was really low. It's gone up a little bit, but I think it's still in the mid $2 a gallon. Haven't been driving much. So I haven't been to the gas. Off normal.
That's a great comparison because that depending what you're I like that a lot. So that's a Chelan County price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and I'm getting Jim is texting me real time here, so I'm getting level 2 chargers are all the same standard. So he wanted to clarify that. And that for level 3 there's Tesla. There's a Japanese Chatomo, and then there's a CCS, and it looks like there are adapters for all of these. And so you can get adapters from one to the other.
Great, thank you.
Yes, you bet.
And Andrew, did you hear Commissioner Smith's follow-up question? Was the 27 cents at Chelan rates?
I believe. That would be, but I will have to confirm.
Okay, we'll get back to you on that one.
We'll get back.
So, Commissioner's bottom line on this is that EVs can be a really good thing. They can be really helpful for a lot of elements of social policy, certainly climate change, et cetera. What we're trying to do is develop a business strategy around it, and so you should anticipate that we'll be bringing you some action items like the changes in rates, not immediately, but be working that into business planning and trying to figure out where the time is that we can get that done. Biggest issue is it sort of looks like HDL or cryptocurrency, just at a slower pace. It can be a substantial drag on the use of our electricity, particularly if you've got folks coming from other places and using it. So we want to make sure that we get in front of that and get rates in place so that we're not trying to change something later and it feels like a take back from people who are using it. Any other questions on that before we move to our next agenda item?
Steve, the only thing, this is Gary, and I'd like to just compliment you on already thinking through this and thinking around the corner with respect to making sure that we don't give this low power rate away to folks that are not from Chelan County. So appreciate that.
Thank
you. Andrew, I really just want to tell you I appreciate particularly slide 7, a range of actions. That mental model kind of clarified my thinking, moving my thinking forward in that, you know, I want in creating, meeting, doing the best for the most in the county here, and supporting our EV adopters at home, and yet, you know, kind of looking at the limiting the utility impact by creating a market approach so that we're not hurting ourselves in our business model. So that sets well with me, and I'm going to look forward to continue to learn and be challenged in my thinking on that. But I like that mental model that's there on page 7 as we move forward.
Thank you.
Okay, Andrew, thank you very much for that presentation. I'd like to move now to agenda item 5, which is a service center update. We've got Dan Frazier and David Lodge here in the room with us today. They are learning how to sit at the table and stay 6 feet apart, doing a good job of that. Who wants to start?
I'll start off. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services.
David Lodge, Project Manager.
And commissioners, we're coming back to you. I think the last time we were here to talk about the service center project itself, it was in the fall, and we talked about a lot about Building A and where we were in the project, and talked about an expansion of the square footage there. So we're really here to update you on what's happened since that time. So we're going to talk about the scope. I'm going to slide 2 there. David has it. We can talk about the scope and what that additional square foot looks like. And we want to talk a little bit about the aesthetics. There's some great pictures, some renderings in the slide deck, especially in the appendices. We want to talk about schedule and where we are at throughout the through our projected schedule. And the budget is really a discussion about what we found out about that additional square footage and what the costs are. Then something we spent a bit of time at the last presentation was project risks, and so we want to update you on where we are with those risks and then get into the next steps that we see coming up over the next several months.
So to start with the scope, you're currently at 90% design development, which when we conclude that phase of the design, we'll move into construction documents and start developing the instructions to contractors for construction. We added the additional square footage to Building A from our last update with the board, and this resolved a number of challenges we were having with the space, and it's really coming together nicely. We've also continued to work on the different public spaces and have provided a number of renderings of what those spaces are starting to look like in this presentation. And then a new item that's come up, and we'll cover a little bit more in a minute, is responding to COVID impacts and how we need to change some of the decisions from our design. But for the most part, we're finding that the decisions we've made to date have positioned us really well for responding to COVID. Because all along, our philosophy was to build flexibility into the project, and we're finding that's really paying off now. But there are a few items that we want to talk about. So as far as schedule, we're still moving forward. And we have developed a phasing plan for the project, and it has an early site work package that we can start this summer and take advantage of the better weather, and then moving into building construction over the winter. So it involves 2 contract amendments to our current contract with Absure Construction, and that would be in the form of 2 resolutions with board action. So to see how that plays out, on the top I've got a schedule here that shows the site work portion of the work, and we have wrapped up the site work documents. We're in the middle of permitting, and we're actually out to bid. We opened the first package last week, which was under budget, which is great, and we're going to be putting our civil package out to bid this week. This will culminate in a presentation to the board mid-July for contract amendment for the site work portion of the work, and then we'd start immediately after. Meanwhile, we continue to work on the building design and move into our construction documents phase and permitting, and then do our bidding with subcontractors in the fall and position ourselves for a contract amendment in December to start the building work. And that would be about a 2-year duration. We're looking at substantial completion near the end of 2022 and move-in following. Something to note here. So we are finishing up our design development phase on the buildings, and we're planning to do a complete cost estimate on that and be prepared to present that cost estimate when we present the contract amendment for site work.
For folks on the phone, there may be somebody who's not on mute. We're getting some feedback.
So in the meantime, I want to give an update on the cost associated with the Building A expansion. And last time we were here, we said that that expansion of about 10,000 square feet would be approximately $5 million. And we came in on our last estimate just under that. So we added basically a bay to the building and then reorganized a lot of the different programming space in that building. And it's really made everything come together in Building A.
David, just for clarity, Building A is which building?
Yeah, Building A is the 4-story people building on the north
okay,
side.
Thank you.
Yeah, great clarification. So to cover some of the project risks that we discussed at our last update, a lot of these are still active, but we're getting closer to resolution on a number of them. So always a project risk during design is additional and unknown stakeholder requirements, which we're still working closely with all of our stakeholders to make sure we build the program correctly. And then Horan Road vacation, we are submitting an application this week for that, and we've been in close contact with the city on that process. Our shoreline, we actually got our approval today, this morning, and so that is resolved, which is great news. And then offsite road improvements, we are in design on those and working closely with the city. And then construction cost escalation, this has taken a new turn, and I'm going to cover that in the next slide. We still have some allowance for construction cost escalation, but this has become a very big unknown. And then ongoing through construction, we have cultural and archaeological mitigation. We're actually starting some exploratory work on site. We started last week with our archaeologist, and that will help advise us on activities through construction, and then typical construction project risks throughout the duration of construction. So a new risk since last time we met is the obvious one, the COVID-19 impacts. So this has two different major impacts on the project. One is an impact during construction, and one is an impact to the scope that we're planning. So to start with the construction, new guidelines for construction with social distancing, PPE, sanitization, those create labor inefficiencies, which do have an impact on cost for the project. Also, there can be potential supply chain disruptions, and we just don't know the full extent yet. And so we know that there will be some costs associated with this. And we're trying to develop a way to bid this so that we don't put unknown risk on the contractor, but we have them price out the risk that they can control. And then a big unknown is related to economic recovery. This has the potential to create more competition in the market and drive pricing down. It also has the potential to drive up the construction demand, and pricing would follow. So we don't know where this will go at this time, but we will know a lot more when we are ready to contract on the buildings, which will be late this year. As far as the scope, we have been looking at all the decisions we've made to date, and so many of them do align well with where we want to go for a post-pandemic design. We've been building flexibility into the design. The space we've allocated for individuals we feel is appropriate, and the cubicle walls may get a little taller than we planned, but we think that we have a good program, and it can respond to what we don't know yet, because this will look different in 2 years than it does today. But some of the things that we are seriously looking at modifying would be our HVAC systems, we're looking at additional filtration and ionization to provide better indoor air quality, and possibly looking at our elevator controls, providing touchless fixtures and more sensors, barriers between employees and between employees and the public, and our material selection, providing for materials that are easy to sanitize and clean. And then furniture, making sure that we build in the barriers and separation between employees. So there's still quite a bit on the table that we're exploring related to that. But none of those, we don't anticipate making any changes to the building footprints or affecting the site plans. We still feel confident about moving forward with the site work phase of the project. I'm going to pause there. Any questions on that?
David, this is Gary. I have a question. You know, in many businesses you go into, they have plexiglass screens up now between cashiers and customers. Will there be any kind of a barrier similar to that for our customer service folks down in the main lobby?
Yes, great question. We are looking at barriers between the customer service representatives and our customers and trying to determine how permanent those barriers are and how large they are. But yes, we are going to provide for barriers. We actually started this conversation during our last cold season, so we planned on doing something already, but has additional demand for that.
Thank you.
Okay, you can always ask questions related to the subject when we get to the end. So for next steps, like I said, we're looking to do a contract amendment in July. So we plan to come back to give a full update again, and then following by a resolution to award the site work package to Abshire Construction. And then we do need to revise our budget to incorporate the expanded square footage in Building A. And we'll do that as part of the annual budget cycle process. And then we'll be back in December for another contract amendment for the balance of the scope. Any questions?
Well, good presentation, good stuff. I'm getting excited. The more pictures you guys show me, the more excited I get. It's like a kid on morning.
I feel the same way when I see the pictures from the architect. They get me excited. And speaking of that, there is an appendix attached to this presentation that has additional renderings from the architect. So please take a look at them.
Yeah, Dan, this is Randy. As it relates to those additional pictures, I'd really like to have my memory refreshed as to right out front of the main business center, the depiction of the dams on the Columbia, if we could have at some point a refresher on what the artist's rendition of what that's going to look like. That the one that you're just looking, that you just popped up, really, I don't know if it does justice or not, but maybe that's the best we have at this point.
We can absolutely get a better shot of that. That's what's nice about this is we're doing it in a model. So we just need to take a photo, a rendering from other locations, so we can kind of show you more of a isometric view of what that looks like.
Yes, definitely. And that's still in development on exactly what that looks like, but we're very excited about the concept of the falling water in the plaza.
And if I recall correctly, you were bringing together potentially some community members to provide input into that?
Yes, we have, and unfortunately, we haven't been able to meet quite a while, but we are working with an advisory group, and we do need to figure out a way to reassemble that group and talk about some of the newest imagery of the public spaces.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dan and David. You will see them back here in July for the board resolution for the site work.
Thank you.
With that, commissioners, we are done with the morning study session items, and we do have a rather large executive session set of items today to discuss, so I would like to, with your approval, move forward to the afternoon business session.
Commissioners, what are your wishes?
Works for me.
Good to me.
No objection.
No objection.
Right. Okay, Steve, I think you got the okay.
Okay, I think we would start with the consent agenda then.
Okay, commissioners, we have before us a consent agenda. What are your wishes?
This is Randy. I would move approval of the consent agenda, which has been amended to include agenda items 10, 11, 12, and 13.
Do I hear a second?
I'll second.
Second.
Steve? It's been moved and seconded. Do we have discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of approving the consent agenda as stated, please say aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it.
Okay, thank you, commissioners. With that, we are ready to turn to agenda item 9. This is a resolution ratifying an interlocal agreement number 19-10436 with the United States Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, USDA APHIS, Wildlife Services of Olympia, Washington, to perform predator control and nuisance bird animal control for northern pike minnow, fur bearers, and piscivorous birds. Dan Frazier gets to join us again.
Thanks, commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services, and I'm going to start this presentation off to explain why this is a ratification and not an approval of an agreement. And it's one of those situations where we have the opportunity for some lessons learned. This was an agreement that we have had for several years with USDA, and the existing agreement was expiring at the end of December. And the agreement that is before you today was negotiated through October, November, and in early December was sent to the USDA for signature. We didn't get it back for some time, and when it did return, it was after the first of the year, and there was the perception of a rush, and some steps were missed in evaluating the level of approval that was needed. So this is a service agreement, that's the SA that we talk about, but it's a service agreement with an agency, and so those are interlocal agreements, and there's two different levels of delegation in the resolution, the delegation resolution. And service agreements are delegated to a level of 500,000, and interlocal agreements are delegated to a level of 200,000. So this being at 488,000 required board action. It was not processed with board action. And so that's why we're back here today. What we've found from this process is there's a few things missing in our evaluation process. And so we're implementing a couple additional steps where different people will check to see what the delegation resolution or what the delegated authority is for any action. And we need to add this to our list of what we call it our cheat sheet. I know there's probably a more technical term for that. But we have a cheat sheet that we use for every different type of delegation. And unfortunately, interlocals were not on that cheat sheet. So when you see an SA, you think, okay, service agreement, and they processed it accordingly. So we're adding interlocals to that cheat sheet. We're also introducing some additional training. Now, on my little tickler file that I have for lessons learned, this is the third one that will come up at our staff meetings in PCS so that we can keep these type of activities from happening too often. But it is a complex business, and it's just a matter of making sure that everybody's trained appropriately to the level of delegation and that the process is followed for each type of action. So that's what we'll be doing going forward.
Great. Thank you, Dan, for explaining that. I appreciate it. Commissioners, any questions for Dan? Hearing no questions, do I hear a motion?
Yes, Gary, I will make the motion, but could somebody help me with the language on the motion?
It's be a motion to approve agenda item 9.
That's presented. Okay, I move that we approve resolution 9 as presented.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on resolution number 9? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of approving resolution number 9 as stated, please say aye.
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 And those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate that. And congratulations on getting the shoreline permit this morning. That was good news.
Great email to get first thing in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Ann. Hey, sorry to interrupt. This is Ann. Congratulations. That's great news. Onward. This is really exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you, Commissioners. Appreciate your support.
And I'll just add that through Dan's good work, we have a very good working relationship with the city of Wenatchee right now that's helping us get through some, there's quite a few permits that have to be granted here. So we're making some good progress there. Okay, Commissioners, we are ready to move to manager items. And I want to start with an update on Coyote Dunes. You may recall Coyote Dunes is the property that we acquired south of the Otobashan Bridge on the Douglas County side of the river. I'm hoping that Jeff Osborne is on the line.
I am on the line. Good morning, everyone. This is Jeff Osborne, Senior License Compliance Specialist. Our intent today is to provide you with an update on the planning efforts and the schedule related to the recreational enhancements for the Coyote Dunes natural area. Begin with a brief bit of history. As Steve just mentioned, you know, this is the area south of the Otobashan Bridge, formerly called the Olds Bridge site. It's located between the Apple Capitol Loop Trail and the river. In 2017, Chelan PUD purchased approximately 26 acres from Washington State Department of Transportation, and this provided us the ownership for the land that we needed to fulfill our obligations in the Rock Island Recreation Plan, which is also called the Exhibit R, that was issued in 1978 with the current license. In January 2018, we filed with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission an application for a non-capacity amendment to do three things, actually to revise the 1978 recreation plan. One, to fine-tune the project boundary to incorporate this new property that we purchased. Two, we renamed the area from the Olds Bridge site to the Coyote Dunes Natural Area, which was a name that was generated through a public process. And then to also provide some conceptual recreational enhancements ideas for the area. So since that time, since 2018, staff have continued to evaluate those initial conceptual designs, and we found that the costs have significantly exceeded engineering estimates, mostly due to the challenges to accessing the site with construction equipment, heavy equipment needed to, say the first thought was to install a vault toilet, and trying to do that proved rather difficult without negatively impacting the loop trail itself and also the natural area itself, some significant potential ground disturbing activities. So our up-to-date today is to provide a schedule and outreach plans to continue the efforts to designs for recreation, education, and environmental enhancement for the area. We plan to provide a similar update that I'm giving to you today to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission later this month. Our next steps are to complete an environmental evaluation and update the initial recreational enhancement concepts that were in 2020 and 2021, and provide FERC with an update by December 1, 2021. The environmental evaluation will include discussions with obviously significant stakeholders and agencies regarding the cultural and native plant features in the area. We're planning to meet with local agencies, specifically the Washington Department of Natural Resources. They actually own the shoreline property area between our Coyote Dunes area and the river. So obviously a very, very important stakeholder that we need to discuss our intentions, be in tune with them, make sure that our management plan is consistent with their goals and objectives. And then our future concepts and designs are expected to incorporate education, conservation, and recreational elements while balancing future growth and public safety in the area. So that is a very brief update, and I will entertain any questions that you may have.
Commissioners, any questions?
All right. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. Everyone, stay safe and healthy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Next up, we have had to make some pretty significant modifications to the delivery of the River of Power program, and so Debbie Kelleher and a guest will be presenting on this.
Good morning. Debbie Gallagher, Discovery Center Manager. Thank you for your time this morning and allowing myself, along with Heather Stringer, to provide a quick overview of our longstanding River of Power program. Due to the school closures this year caused by COVID-19, we were in dire need of a solution to bring this amazing STEM project, River of Power, to the fourth grade children in Chelan and Douglas County. Bob Bauer and I met with Heather earlier this spring to come up with a plan on how we could continue with this program in 2020. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to turn this over to Heather, and she's going to give you an update on what she did to make all of this happen. Heather?
Good morning, Heather Stringer. I'm a science cadre member for the North Central Education Service District. My goal is to bring River of Power and energy education to students in Chelan, Douglas, Okanagan, and Grant counties through the PUD. In the spring, the last week of May, first week of June, we always have a really large field trip for fourth graders in Chelan and Douglas County out of Rocky Reach Dam called River of Power. It serves approximately 1,400 fourth graders, 23 different elementary schools, and about 60 classes. And since we couldn't have the students out of Rocky Reach Dam, we created a virtual field trip for them using a platform that they are all currently using with their online classes called Google Classroom. You should have it in front of you, and the Google Classroom went out to all of the different fourth grade teachers in Chelan and Douglas County several weeks ago. Students were able to access the classroom and they could visit the three most important stations that they would get to experience out at the dam, including Build a Dam, Salmon Art, and Energy Transfer. They have activities, videos, games that they can play, all embedded in this Google Classroom. Students were able to access it whenever the teacher assigned it. We didn't have any problems getting it out to any of the classrooms. There was only one private school in Wenatchee that wasn't using Google Classroom, and so I created a Google document with everything embedded, all the links, and was able to send it out that way, and students were able to access it on their own from their home computers without any problems. We are looking at the possibility of not being able to have our fall River of Power out at Chelan Falls in October, which would have Manson School District, Chelan, Mansfield, and Pateras. So not only will they have the option of this Google Classroom in the fall, I also created another option using Google Slides that is even easier to use with students just touching different objects on their screen and going straight into the activities, the videos, and the games. So that will go out in the fall if we need to. I'm currently working with Grant PUD to bring our education, energy education program to their students. Since I wasn't able to get to all of their schools, I created Google Classrooms for second grade and fourth grade. And if I'm not able to get to schools in Chelan County in the fall, they will also have those same Google Classrooms for energy education sent to their second grade classes and their fourth grade classes. I've been talking to Debbie about these energy education Google Classrooms that were created, and we even think that it may be a good idea to send them out to classes prior to me coming and bringing the education program to their room, just so they have some prior knowledge when I show up. So even once we're past all of the closures because of COVID, we can still use these Google Classrooms and Google Slideshows just to have the kids have some prior knowledge before they go on the field trips or before they have the programs in their school. Do you have any questions?
Commissioners, questions?
Hi, this is Steve McKenna. Heather, I just wanted to commend you that I think it's pretty remarkable how quickly everybody has adapted in their teaching with technology to meet the needs of kids. And this is an example of that, and I just appreciate all your work in trying to make that happen for our kids. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure. Any other questions?
Comments and questions, commissioners?
I'd just like to add my thanks to, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
This is Gary, and I just wanted to comment that I was very impressed as I read through my meeting material about how you've adapted, similar to what Commissioner McKenna was saying. You've adapted to the coronavirus. You've been able to use Google Classroom. Very impressive. And I just want to commend you for the work well done and letting the kids at least have exposure at some level to the hydro system. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And if I could just add, these guys have done a really great job on this. There is also ongoing work between the Educational Service District and Debbie and her team looking forward to the STEM conference that's being put together. Originally, that was going to be in Wenatchee. As I understand it, it will not be, but finding ways to be able to get this message out to a larger audience than just Chelan, Grant, and Douglas counties. So at a future date, we're going to have Debbie back to talk some more about that.
Well, Steve, just very quickly, Heather is working with our to bring this to a virtual conference. So, Heather, if you want to quickly. Yes, Bob and I are working on the same platform of Google Classroom to take the electricity production science kit that has been created by Chelan PUD and bring it to all the teachers at the STEM Summit in August so that they can easily access this science kit and bring it to their students virtually if they need to, or if we're back in the classrooms in the fall, then they'll have all the tools ready to implement it in person.
Terrific. Thank you very much for that. With that, Commissioner's ready to turn to the next item, and that is Kathy Melton, who will give an update on some utility service regulations that will be modified.
Hello, Commissioners. Kathy Melton, Customer Service Program Analyst here. And I have just a really brief update of one section within our utility service regulations that we will be seeking an amendment in. There's going to be no action requested for today, but so this is just giving you an opportunity to hear about our recommendation and, of course, ask any questions that you may have with that. So you'll see on slide 3 that provides you with a summary of the basis for this recommendation, and this is in response to an adjustment that was made from the National Electric Code that sets the minimum standards for safe electrical design and installation. And this is now requiring customers to have an outdoor located emergency disconnect on new homes or homes that are undergoing an upgrade to their service. And the purpose of that emergency disconnect is to help our emergency responders mitigate those electrical hazards that they may face when they're responding to a home fire or some kind of a disaster. Now, because the district does not require these emergency disconnects to be placed, we wanted to specify within our own regulations that this is something that's required by a different agency, and that device should be located on the customer side of the meter, not on the utility side of any of those services infrastructure. So that's really what we were wanting to do, is just clarify the location of this device within our regulations. It's not going to change how we do business today, and we're relatively comfortable that this is not going to be a surprise for any of those customers, or really for those contractors and builders or electricians. The NEC does a really great job of involving the public and industry members within their discussion points when they're considering adjustments to their codes. But we will likely have some courtesy information for awareness posted on our website for our customers, just so that there's not any surprises or any bottlenecks there. And our hope with that is to come back to one of our following board meetings with a resolution to adopt that amendment into the section within our regulations. Are there any questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
This really jumps out at me. I'd like to hear some conversation about those of us that live in rural areas, how this works in a personal security arena with the potential for home invasion. That you know, this external cutoff, power can be cut off by somebody outside of a home and with somebody inside. Is that correct?
Well, I, you know, in all honesty, I would probably have to go back and look at some of the NEC language a little bit closer. I think it would still be somewhere that would be somewhat protected. It's my understanding that it would be somewhere close to the meter, but I think you do raise an excellent question. I'm not sure if there's additional security measures that the NEC is requiring for that as far as the device that they're wanting to have installed. I could certainly research that and have that information available when we return.
I would really appreciate that, because it seems like you're trading one type of security issue for potentially another one.
Of course. No, I'd be happy to research that and provide some answers back.
Thank you.
All right, if there's no other questions, thank you very much. I'll get some information and respond back and provide that to the commission, and then we will be back at one of the following meetings.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, Carrie Wendell will provide what has become a regular COVID-19 update.
Good morning, commissioners. This is Carrie Wendell, Customer Relations Manager. I'm here to update you on the customer impacts that we're seeing from COVID-19. Same presentation that I've been giving, just updated, and the information that I'm providing today is based on the information up to May 26th. So as we move to slide 2 regarding the unemployment trends, you can see that the trends are still up. They're still driven by non-disclosed industries, food services, accommodations, and retail, and there's still a small portion of forest and ag activities that were included with those numbers.
So, Carrie, question, this is Randy. I've been watching this now for several weeks, and I'm making the assumption that these numbers are not all cumulative, but during that same process, some people do return to work. Am I accurate with that assumption?
That's our understanding, Randy. I can check into that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So as we move to slide 3, these are the customers that have self-reported that they are affected by COVID. So you can see from those numbers, we went from 217 on May 6th up to 230, an increase of about 10 residential customers and an increase of about three commercial customers that have contacted us. So part of that information that you had requested was based on the credit scores, and you can see from that those numbers didn't change very much either. We're still about 41% of the customers, residential customers, are paying on time, that normally pay on time, that are not typically late, and then about 59% of those customers are typically late for the residential. Commercial, close to the same numbers. We have about 64% of those commercial businesses that normally and typically pay on time, and about 36% that are the ones that are typically late. And then to date, as of May 26th, there has been 159 customers, residential customers, approved for energy assistance. And we currently do not have any of those customers set up with payment arrangements. Any questions on that slide? Okay, we'll move to slide 4. So this slide is the same one that you've seen, the retail revenue past due. As you can see, that there's not a lot of change from 2019 to now with the residential past due. And actually, the commercial is the same. So those numbers are close to the same as the last presentation. Any questions on that slide? So we can move to the next slide. This slide here is more information regarding the retail past due. At this time, we have under 300 customers that are past due. So I think that number was over 1,200 that we had that have went into this over the 65 days past due, and now we're under 300 of them. The disconnect notices, as you can see, those have went way down for the month of May. And we have about 12 payment arrangements that were pending, which is lower than what we've had since we started the conversation in April. And the similar percentages as the last presentation. So not a lot of change again. So I'm not sure if anyone have any questions on that slide? Okay, so we can move to the last slide. This one is regarding the Helping Hand distribution. In May, the numbers, it's a little bit less. There are about 38 customers have been in the past due status that are affected by COVID that we have helped. And from that, the numbers on the right-hand side regarding the contributions and the balances, those new updates will be coming in the first of this week for the amounts that were given out in May. So hopefully this helps. You can see that, you know, things haven't changed a lot. I'm not sure if we're going to see more impacts as we go forward, but at this point, That's the update that I have for you, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those now.
Carrie, this is Gary, and I just have a question on the Helping Hands slide. Help me to understand, is there a process at Helping Hands for someone to qualify for assistance?
Well, as of now, Gary, or Commissioner Arsenault, I'm sorry, if they are in a past due status of past 65 days and they have self-reported to us, we've been requesting the Helping Hand funds through Community Action.
Okay. And so is it, of those people that are past due, of those folks, would it be reasonable to assume that all of them might qualify for Helping Hands?
Yes.
Okay. So and that's a process ongoing with the PUD, right? That we're talking with each of these folks and trying to get them over to the Helping Hands so that they can get relief, correct?
Correct. We're working with them to see if they qualify for the Energy Assistance Program first. And in the event that they qualify for that, as you can see, those numbers have jumped up quite a bit. So most of our customers are qualified for the Energy Assistance Program. And then we also have the group that are qualified, that we qualify for Helping Hand.
Okay, thanks. I wasn't sure if there was some type of an income threshold or something that might prevent people from getting assistance at Helping Hands.
Normally that would be the case, but at this point we're trying to help a lot of those customers that are self-reporting to us, as well as their balances are becoming past 65 days.
Yeah, as time passes, that balance becomes more difficult for them to eventually pay. That's my concern. So thank you for the good work that you and your crew are doing.
Thank you.
Commissioners, I'll just maybe wrap this section up by saying that part of the reason that we keep bringing these numbers back is because we've discussed the idea of revisiting what actions maybe we may take in July. I will tell you that I'm surprised that we're not seeing a disturbing trend here. Would have anticipated more challenges than what we've seen so far. But it's still early, and so we'll continue to report on this at each board meeting and then come back and have a more in-depth discussion about what we might do, whether we go above and beyond these programs for the post-July period. I would also like to take this moment just to say that late breaking news. We did get new proclamations from the governor over the weekend. I have not had an opportunity to discuss this with staff, and so I'm going to just opine on it for a moment. And then stand corrected if we learn more later in the week. Two things about it. There are some issues that are raised by the proclamation that would be a concern to all consumer-owned utilities in the state with respect to authorities that the governor is asserting over making policy for consumer-owned utilities and the relationship of consumer-owned utilities to the state's Utilities Transportation Commission. But having said that, the specific items that are included in the proclamation do not appear to be contrary to actions that this board has already taken, including a commitment to not have disconnects through the end of July and to provide programs for late payment that would include deferrals and payment plans. So substantively, it doesn't appear that that there is a concern created by the proclamations, but there could be some longer-term issues that I'm sure will be addressed through the Washington PUD Association. Any questions about that? Okay, with that, I want to turn to Mike Coleman for an update on the community Wi-Fi access points and some good news with respect to low-cost programs.
Okay, thank you. Commissioners, Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications. And I'm actually going to touch on three areas today, the low-cost packages, the hotspots, and the bandwidth. So the great news today is that Localtel is ready to roll out a low-cost package. They're calling it Internet Lite. It's an Internet package with reduced bandwidth, reduced features, at a reduced cost. And when you look at it, it's actually what I consider to be a very, very good package. It's a 30 by 5 megabits per second service. It does have a 200 gigabyte capacity data cap, and additional gigabytes are available for 20 cents per gigabyte over the cap. And when you compare that to what the cellular companies are charging, that's a marvelous bargain. Also, there is no CPE installation fees, and it goes for $29.95 a month. As part of this, Dimitri was unable to be here today, but he did send me a statement that he wanted me to share with you. He said, "We look forward to rolling out this new service that will help the PUD customers who could benefit from the combined efforts of the PUD and Localtel to provide a lower cost option." So this low-cost package does require a simple change to the wholesale telecommunication service fees and charges schedule. And although the approval of that is delegated to the general manager, we obviously have to inform the board before we implement it. And so the installation and provisioning fees would be waived for each order for this service, where the service provider is providing a verified low-cost package to end users. And to implement this service, the district would simply create a new entry in the portal that retail service providers could choose when setting up the new service. This option allows the waiver of the fees to occur automatically, and it also provides reporting capabilities for the district on these low-cost packages. It's a very simple change. It does not affect any of the rates, and therefore it is easy to implement. But we would like to inform you today that we are making that change in the fees and charges schedule to waive those charges only for the low-cost packages. The other good news is that Native Networks notified me that they will also be offering a low-cost package, and I'll follow up with details hopefully in the next board meeting. And if there's no question on that item, I'll move to the hotspots.
Mike, this is Steve McKenna.
Yes.
I can't let you move on to the next item until I comment on this. But I know how excited you are to share this information because I won't be bugging you every time I see you asking you when is this going to occur? Have we heard any news from our providers? And I am really excited to hear this news to provide an opportunity for low-income folks, families, to have some internet access and bridge that equity gap that so many face. This is a big deal to me, and I'm pleased that I won't be bugging you about this. And I'll be looking forward to hear how, you know, the other information about the other providers as well. So thank you for your work. I know I haven't been easy to live with on this issue, and I appreciate all your efforts.
Thank you. And just to add another point of detail here, this is a low-cost package, not just a low-income package, although it can be used for either. The really good news is if somebody qualifies for the FCC Lifeline discount, which is aimed at low-income individuals, then that Lifeline discount is $9.25 a month. So Localtel will facilitate those that are eligible for that discount, and they will be able to get that additional $9.25 a month off of this package. So that's a fantastic deal for the low-income individuals. So I do appreciate the thank you, Commissioner McKenna. I'm going to move on to the hop.
With that, and I appreciate the clarification on low cost versus low income. I just lost my train of thought there. Does this coincide with what providers have experienced during COVID, or is this just, they've been working on this and it just happens to coincide? So was the COVID a driving factor, or was this just coincidence?
I think the COVID only added emphasis to what we were already working on. This was not an easy thing for them to design just the right package. It also required hardware because they have to manage this bandwidth. And so it seems coincidental that it came with COVID. It also was simply because it took so long to get here. It was a good thing because the educational community was looking for a way to get to low-cost packages for many of their students' families. So I look at it and say it took a lot of hard work, and it took some hard decisions on the part of the service providers to get to this point.
And will they be doing the marketing on that, or is there a role that the PUD plays in that as well?
They will be doing the marketing because each of the service providers that chooses to offer it may offer a slightly different package. They could choose several different parameters that they wanted to focus on, and they will be marketing it directly to the end users as their service.
Perfect. Thank you, Mike.
Certainly. Moving on to the hotspots, we have one additional hotspot that's come up since the last board meeting, and that's one that Native Networks put in at the Senior Center on Maple Street. However, there are several more on the way. At the Malaga Firehouse, they're waiting on final approval from the fire chief for an installation there. There is another one in Malaga at the Washington Growers League. This was a location requested by Wenatchee School District, and it is pending the scheduling of the installation now. Native is also working on several additional sites. And with that, I will move on to the bandwidth. What we're seeing now is a trend of bandwidth usage coming back down to the pre-COVID levels or maybe slightly above it. There's variation from week to week. The network is doing exceptionally well. With the changes we made back in late March, early April, all of our indicators and metrics within the network are well in the green. We think this trend is related to more people going back to work and many more people spending time outside now that the weather is better. And this appears to be a normal trend across the industry with some exceptions for specific areas. So good news all the way around.
I'll say it is. Good report, Mike.
Thank you.
That's it for our manager items, and we are ready to move on to commission items.
Commissioners, do we have any news to share?
So, Gary, when appropriate, I have something that I'd like to share.
Steve, I think you're cleared to go.
Okay, this may take a few minutes. And I may have to stop every once in a while and compose myself, so I'll apologize in advance. You know, for all of us, and I'm going to talk personally myself, that during this COVID situation, I found it interesting how my emotions run. You know, what one minute there's fear, next minute I'm at home, I'm working on my project. It's like life is normal, and geez, can't we get back to, you know, things seem normal, and why, you know, what's all the fuss about? And I understand all the different points of view in hunkering down, wanting to get things going, get businesses going. And I'm a little concerned with, as we reopen things, and particularly concerned about as we look at things at the PUD, that we look forward to the future, but let's not forget about the past. And I'd like to do this with a personal story. Again, I'm at home. I'm down here by the Icicle River. It's quiet. I'm mowing my lawn, everything. I'm working in my garden, reading a book on the deck. Everything is, you know, it's easy for me to stay at home, and life's pretty normal. And yet, I've got a daughter who is a frontline ICU nurse in on the west side, dealing with death. 27-year-old head nurse who's really fought a battle and talks about how this has impacted her life. And she's never going to be the same again. It's been very tough on her. But even with that, because we're stay at home, I haven't seen her for a month. I talk to her, and again, I get a little complacent about where I'm at personally, even though I know she's struggling. And the other day, several weeks ago, I was informed by one of the kids of one of my best friends that he has COVID and he's at the hospital that my daughter is working, and that he's in intensive care. So I'm shocked with the news. And it's been almost 4 weeks now that he's been on a ventilator. And he lost his battle last Wednesday. Now, this guy is 50 years old, he jogs, he's healthy, he has no underlying health problems, and he's a pastor of a church. I know this guy, the kindest guy in the world. He's a hugger, and I'm sure he contracted that disease in his contacts with his parishioners. Everybody loved this guy. And he's no longer with us. He lost his battle. And my hope, as we open up the PUD and we get going back to things as normal, is just a request that those of us who are in our normal routines and
and this has not affected us, that we don't become complacent and end up in a situation where somebody in our PUD family or in our extended families at home, as we reopen, we let our guard down, and somebody else dies from this. It is serious. It's ripping families apart. It's ripping our businesses apart and our communities apart. We all want this to be over. But let's just continue to be vigilant, continue to be cautious. We need to take risks. We need to move forward. But let's keep reminding each other that this isn't anything to mess around with. And so that's kind of my wish, my prayer for everybody. From a guy who's struggling. That's it. Thanks.
Steve, thank you for sharing, Steve.
Thank you, yes.
And on that, I
Harry, this is Ann.
Yes, Ann, please.
I just have a quick comment. On a trip back from Wenatchee the other day, I grabbed some lunch, and 97A is close, so I drove down the east side, which I do regularly, actually. It was beautiful. And I stopped at the Arundo Park. I think there was one person there. He was in and out on a motorcycle. But anyway, I took my lunch, walked down to the river, sat at the picnic table, and ate my lunch. And it is absolutely gorgeous. I've never seen it look so nice. I know that we've taken over the maintenance of it, maintenance and operation, I think, correct? So I just wanted to say kudos to everybody who's involved, and it's a beautiful park. If the rest of you haven't been there, I suggest you take a picnic lunch or take your kids and go there. It's beautiful.
Thank you, Ann.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. We will pass that on to staff.
Commissioners, any other comments?
Commissioners, I think we're in a position that we may be able to finish off the morning, or excuse me, the afternoon agenda even. So Lisa Sanders is here to do commission travel.
Good morning. We don't have any travel scheduled. I do have all commissioners but Commissioner Bowles registered for the APPA, it's now called the Public Power Connect, the remote APPA conference. Other than that, I have all hotel rooms canceled until October. Is there anything that I can help with or I should have on the list?
Lisa, this is Gary. I have a question. I noticed the NWPPA has dropped off the list. Did I miss something on that?
When is that?
Well, it was, I'd have to look back on our previous commissioner travel report, but I thought it was in June. I could be wrong. That there was a virtual NWPPA meeting. Maybe Ann knows more about that.
Oh, I do. I do because I'm a board member. No, that was canceled.
Okay.
It came out in an email. And the annual meeting has tentatively been rescheduled for September.
Oh, good. Okay, thank you.
With more information coming as we know more.
Okay. Thanks, Ann. Thanks, Lisa. That's all I know.
Okay.
Lisa, this is Dennis.
Hi, Dennis.
Hey, on the June 25th, we'll put a water committee meeting in Olympia.
Yes.
It looks like everybody's scheduled. I will not be attending.
Okay.
Okay, commissioners, if there are no other items on travel, I'm going to move to the delegation of action items. We have a
Steve,
few...
can I?
Sorry.
Steve, can I just say one more thing just to let Lisa know? And that is, and Randy, you'll maybe be able to help me out with this, but having been just re-elected to the secretary position at WPUTA, there will be meetings that occur that I'm unaware of at this point. I'm not aware of the schedule.
Okay.
But I will endeavor to inform you when those meetings pop up. They'll anyway, just wanted to call that to your attention.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You bet.
And congratulations, Commissioner Arsenault, on your election.
Thank you very much.
Okay, delegation of action items. We have quite a few we're just going to run through here that are now completed. Rebecca was going to work with the commissioners on calendar invites for the WPUTA Strategic Planning Committee and annual meetings, coordination with Commissioner Smith. That has been completed. Rebecca was also going to work with Commissioner Arsenault on digital signature pilot project. That's been completed. And my understanding, we now have digital signatures for a whole bunch of documents, and it's all working really well. So we seem to have made a giant leap forward there in terms of being able to do it without having to have commissioners drive down to Wenatchee. Rebecca is also arranging for training on how to find archived meeting books. That is completed and hopefully is available to all the commissioners now. We had an item that Eric would follow up with Charles Follis, the gentleman who appeared before the board probably 2 months ago in regard to his Entiat property. Eric has done that. Still waiting to see how he wants to resolve the issue. It's pending between he and his attorney. We also have some items from the board workshop. Eric was going to propose new board balance scorecard language for the general counsel annual evaluation. That has been completed. Eric was going to initiate a process to review the governance policy manual and code of ethics. That's been initiated and will not be completed until the board workshop in the fall. And Eric and Rebecca have added the group agreement to the new commissioner orientation. I believe those are our action items. Any questions about any of those? Okay, there are a couple of items. Rebecca will be following up with Commissioner Bowles and Commissioner Congdon on board workshop items regarding how to address balanced scorecard items. So you can expect to hear from her on that. I've got four items that from today's meeting for delegated action items. The first one, actually, I think is already complete. Andrew came up with the 27 cents per gallon equivalent for EV. Well, actually, there's an open question with respect to whether that was at Chelan rates. So we knew NEC requirements for emergency disconnects and determine whether there's a limitation on who can access those. And Carrie will confirm whether the unemployment numbers are a snapshot or cumulative, whether they take into account people going back to work. Did we miss anything?
I think that sounds good to me.
So at this point, I think we'd be open to whether there's any additional public comment, and then we could probably also, after that, make the motion with respect to executive session.
Okay. So at this point, I'd like to invite members of the public to that would be interested in making comment to do so. I'll open the phones now, and if you wish to speak, please state your name, your address for the record, and please limit your comments to 3 minutes. Hearing no public comment, we'll move on to any matters of general business that may be necessary. And hearing none of that, we do have need for an executive session. I believe it would be 2 hours. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the executive session will be to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement action, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by RCW, and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by RCW. What we'll do is we'll take a break now, a one-hour break for lunch. We will go immediately into executive session at 1 o'clock when we come back. And
Justin, Gary?
Sorry. Yes. Yes, Ann.
How's everybody feel about a half-hour break instead of an hour?
I'm good with that.
I'm good.
I'm good. Okay.
Okay, so let's, I'm looking at the clock now. It's 12:03. Why don't we just make it 12:30 that we will re-adjourn into executive session at 12:30. And everyone has the correct phone numbers, correct?
Yes. Thanks.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, then we are adjourned for 30 minutes, and we will meet again at 12:30. Thank you, everyone. So, we are coming out of executive session. It is June 1, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned.